Station number 16711, Fred Welsh, reel 6.
Mr. Welsh, reel 6. You were telling me about the chap who was trying to catch you up when you'd gone to Egypt.
We were by then, we were up in the Gazala line. And one night, this Mr. Ord, called him, arrived. And he finally made it back to his own platoon. And by then, I'd risen to the wonderful rank of Lance Corporal. And I was going out on a night guard to guard a gap in the minefields, which every night you were on that, you would be stoked. Now, to me, you hear a lot about stokers. But once you'd been stoked once or twice, the noise was worse than anything else. And by moving and running away out of range, you could just lie cosily and watch them bomb. Now, when we got to this minefield gap, I said to this young man, I said, I'll put you on first while it's light for you to get used. 9 till 10, 9 till 11. Oh, 8 till 10, sorry. And at 9, when the sun set, you couldn't look at it. It was so bright. Now, I says, out of that sun will come the stokers. I says, you just come to the slit rent as fast as you can. You're not running away. I says, it's passive air defence. I said, PAD, you practiced it all in your training. And I think he was mesmerised by the stokers and was cleaned out and got killed. And the man on with him just jumped into the trench and just, not saying we were brave, it was just the common sense thing to do. But this soldier never fired a shot in anger.
And how does the loss affect you?
Well, you've got, I suppose, put it out of your mind. I would say a death was easier than an injury, because you saw the injury, but the death was taken straight away. I'm not saying you didn't think about the poor dead person, but you maybe had to keep a guy bleeding and his legs broken and shot and everything for beside you till you could get them away. And that was worse than ever.
Can we come back to Tiverton?
Yes.
Have you any other memories of Tiverton which are outstanding?
The send-off.
When was this? The time that you were leaving, of course, for
May.
For
May. May time.
Had you had embarkation leave?
Yes. Yes, it was 2 or 3 days.
How did your parents take the fact that their youngest son was going abroad, youngest child?
Well, my parents never showed anything, but my mother would be. I know when I came back how my mother felt. I find when I came back, my mother was more we got the embarkation day was in 2 sections. Half went one week and half the other. Fortunately, we got trains from Tiverton Junction and special trains brought you right to Newcastle. Got 3 or 4 days and you were supposed to be sacred. You weren't supposed to tell anybody you were going abroad, but how can you not tell your mother that you're going abroad? And they would accept it. And I remember I had a sister lived at Bishop Middleham, 2 miles from where we lived. And she was the last one I went to see before I left. And I came back, and the family were trying to pack my kit bag. They just couldn't. They couldn't do it. And you didn't know then, but you've realised later that this was trouble in their minds. And I just packed my bag, and a friend of mine had a little car. He took us to Darlington and went back to Tiverton, and that was it.
Had you had any inclination as to which area of the world you would be going prior to leaving Tiverton? I'm thinking in terms of where you issued, for example, with KD.
You weren't. You were told you didn't know where you were going. You had no idea where you were going. But you got kitted out with desert topies, desert KB, so it was common sense. You knew where you were going. And you got fitted out with this kit, a long pair of trousers, a short pair of trousers, and we thought it was wonderful kit, dressed to the nines, and topies, not pith helmets, topies, the high-pointed ones, army issue of the time of day. And
did you have to parade with this equipment on to show your officers that it...
Oh, yes, had to get dressed in and let him see, yes.
It must have been pretty cold in the winter.
Yes, but this was done in the barracks. In the, I'm saying barracks, ours was a scout hut. And you packed all your kit, and other kit was spent up to Bransworth Castle, I suppose. What you weren't using that was surplus, because you weren't allowed to carry too much, you were going on a troop ship. And on the Thursday and Friday, you received the last of your inoculations, and when we got inoculation, you weren't allowed out for 24 hours. Then on Saturday, you were confined to your billet area, which to us was just the length of a street. We used to march down this street to the cookhouse, and near a pub, the Wee Chief. And they did get permission to get in the Wee Chief on the Saturday night, and but you had to be back for 10 o'clock. And real MPs, not your regimental MPs, Redcaps, were in charge of Tiverton on then. They drafted in. And I have photographs of that day, the Saturday. People lent you cameras and so on. And by now, I think the town knew that the battalion was leaving, and began to show signs of, well done, lads, you're going to do it for us at last. And it was a military parade when we went down to Tiverton railway station. We marched through the town with the band and the bugles. Sunday night, about between 4 and 6, and even churches and chapels put the services back an hour to give us a send-off. And the streets were lined that day, and you did feel proud that you were going to try and do something for them. Of course, you couldn't march very well. You were carrying loads of kit and kit bags, and marvellously organised. You marched onto a Tiverton railway area stations, and you didn't even walk up and down the platform. You just walked straight into the door of the carriage that you were going to travel in, because it was overnight travel.
What date was this?
This was in the month of May.
1941.
41, yes. And the whole division was on the move then, and we steamed through the night, and you weren't even allowed to write home that you were leaving. But what did happen, whether they ever got anywhere, we don't know. But odd lads wrote letters on the train and put stamps on, throw them out the train window, whether anybody picked them up. We did stop in Carlisle, because we went to Gourock. in Scotland to leave. Whether anybody did post these letters, we don't know. I didn't bother. I was never an emotional person. And
how did they feed you on this long journey?
Oh, you're just given a haversack ration. Put in your bag. Again, we're back to the sandwiches. Thick wads of bread and, again, cheese. I think they must have got this cheese given in the army. And
how did you feel? You'd obviously never been abroad. How did you feel leaving the country?
Well, as I say again, today education has gone on leaps and bounds. But we landed in Scotland at Gourock, and I was going to sail. I didn't know then, but I was booked on a ship called SS Arjuna, which couldn't get into the docks. They were out at sea. And we put on these little steamers who took you out and put you on. And we were so well educated, we thought we were going abroad on these little steamships. And that was my estimation of the world in those days. It was very poor. We weren't, you didn't have television, you just had a wireless. And I mean, even London was just a name of a city, the capital of England. But every thought, boy, I'd be roofing here on these wooden seats. There were little paddle steamers, and you had to climb up the steps when you got to the boat. And nobody has seen anything in their lives until they've seen a troop ship in those days.
Were you looking forward to going abroad when you heard that you were going?
Yes, excited and a change, a new adventure.
Did the thought of impending danger and fighting enter into it, into your mind?
The only thing that I was ever concerned about was being blinded. That's the only thing that I was frightened of. I'd never seen death. I didn't think death was for me in those days. Never mentioned my head. I only ever knew one man who could see he wasn't coming back, and he didn't. He had the premonition, but I never did have the premonition of that. Never.
You mentioned the troop ship being quite a unique vessel. In what ways? What was a troop ship like in those days?
Well, this had been converted from a meat carrier from Buenos Aires to England. And we went down, I don't know how far we were down. And you were taken, and there was a table fastened onto the side of the ship, outwards towards the inner. And 16 of you sat on one side, and 16 of you sat on the other. And above where you sat was a hook, and there was a hook at the other side. And the man opposite you had the same sort of two hooks, and that was where you slung your hammocks. And that's the amount of room you had, about a square yard. It was absolutely crowded. You couldn't move down on those mess decks where you ate, slept, you had lectures, because they tried to keep some sort of training going all the time, all that, and we were at sea quite a long time. We were at sea when the Hood got sunk, and we weren't too far off it because our two escort vessels, which one was the famous Exeter, they left to go and fight this big battleship that had sunk the Hood, and our convoy was left without any sort of cover at all from the Navy for a while.
You said the decks were crammed. How did you take to sleeping on hammocks?
Well, it took me a long, long time.
Were you able to get in and out of them okay?
Well, I was. Again, I was tall. He stood on the table and could get hold of girders and pull yourself up with your hands first before you touch the hammock. So you weren't tipping the hammock over to get in. You got in it properly. There was trouble, you know. It was fun at times, you know. Jokes, but...
Are they comfortable to sleep in when you get used to them?
Well, it was never comfortable because at 10 o'clock lights were put out and it was as black as Whitby Jet till 6 o'clock in the morning. And you couldn't even find your way to the toilet during the night. You had to wait till morning. You couldn't find your way in anything. People vacated the hammocks, slept on the table, slept under the table, slept on the benches that were what you sat on to try and get more comfortable. And one man, the worst poor man, we lost him completely, disappeared. And they had to search the ship for him. And he was found right in the bottom and he was laid on the potatoes. And he was dying of seasickness. And when we found him, we were near Aden, and he was taken off at Aden and flown home with a sunburned flying boat, desperately ill. Had never known anybody be so ill with seasickness. He just couldn't beat it at all.
Man. Where did they keep the hammocks?
Well, you just rolled them up, and they were in cupboards at the on the side. You open doors and there were cupboards there. And it all had to be done by numbers. It wasn't just, you didn't bundle them in. They had to be folded in the right line and put in the right line so that you could get yours out at night. You didn't just bundle them up and lock the door. Because there was a 10 o'clock every day, there was a ship's inspection. Everyone had a boat station where your boat was if anything happened. And your boat drill and ship's inspection were one and the same. And the two men who were on mess duty were allowed to stay on stand at the mess head, and the utensils were inspected. You were inspected on the at your boat drill. A funny story there. We had a little sergeant who was rather a pompous little man. He loved his little bit of authority. And you had to tell the officer in charge who was on parade. Well, there would be two men on the mess duty, and there'd be two men on Achak duty, on the Bren gun, right on the top of the ship. And this man started off, and he used to shout, 29 men on parade, sir, two men on mess duty, and one man on Achak duty. And as the time went on, when we hit these storms in the Atlantic, it finished up our shouting, 29 men sick, two men on duty. And I was very, very fortunate. The only fear I had was seasickness, and I loved the sea. And finished up, I was on duty for weeks on this machine gun on top of the Corporal Jarvis and me, a lad from Liverpool. I'd been at sea, so he knew it. But the others, seasickness was terrible. Only thing, good thing about seasickness for me, I got plenty to eat because they couldn't eat. And another good thing out of it was when they got the sea legs and we were getting into calmer waters, you were let off duties because you'd done so much while they were all sick. So in the med, I just laid about and listened to lectures and did PT. I were always doing PT. But you hadn't much room. I remember one poor man we used to do We used to put our life jackets on the deck and use them as a mat for PT. And we were doing forward rolls, learned to do forward rolls. And this man jumped too high and bumped his head on the girder and fractured his skull. Just little things happened. Wasn't seriously injured, like he got better. That was the end of the PT, right? We didn't do any more of that.
Were there any other drills that you were able to do on the ship? Weapons at all?
Well, you were always cleaning weapons because salt, the sea, you had to keep them. And, your rifle was always kept what they called dry, clean, and slightly oiled, but you kept as much grease and oil on it as you could at sea to keep away rust, or hard to clean. And of course, you only got Bren guns out for a lecture. If you, you know, you got, you had to learn how to strip a Bren gun and rebuild a Bren gun, even with arms, blindfolded. But that's about all you could do in lectures about the war.
Did you get any opportunity to practice your shooting at sea, shooting in the
water? No, no. No, there's never room for that. A cartoon appeared on the ship's notice board one day of a space they'd found on this ship, about 6 yards square, I'll say. And the officer saying, damn it, he says, I could have got another two battalions in that corner. Put up by some wag. Cause it, oh, the... You finished up, but when you were in the med, people were sneaking out to sleep on deck, on top, they were all over. But the trouble, I tried it twice, but the trouble with that, the crew of the Arjuna had to clean it while they started work at 3, while they were swilling you with seawater at 4:30 in the morning, so you had to be up. So you were having long days if you slept out there.
You mentioned the duty that you had was on the anti-aircraft.
Bren gun.
Was this part of the defence of the ship, of course?
Oh, yes, to help out, yes. Yeah, that was before 1941. There wasn't many guns on these sort of ships. You were at...
What did that entail, exactly?
Well, you were right on the top of the ship, as high as you could get with the Bren gun, and for anti-aircraft. Because you were always seeing Fokker Wolfs, which were reconnaissance planes of the German Air Force. But we never had many scares. We were looking, just the one when the hood was there, and we put all the haste on there.
How long would your duty last on this anti-aircraft?
Oh, daylight to dark. Not me all the time, but daylight to dark, there was somebody on duty. And there was always people with binoculars all around the decks on duty, looking for subs and looking for aircraft. Because in the med it was like a mill pond, and it was hot all the time, you could see for miles.
How was discipline exacted on the best decks? Was there some organised discipline down there?
Well, there was your corporal was in charge of the table, or your sergeant. But by now, we were disciplined. We didn't need discipline. No, we knew that we were now soldiers, and petty arguments, I suppose the worst of them, but they weren't encouraged, and bonds were made between people, as I say. And that's the word, bond.
What did you do for leisure activities? Keep yourselves occupied. It was a very long journey.
Activities was absolute. I've never played since. Endless bingo. From morning till night. Whoever was off duty, they were running a bingo school. And you sometimes had a ship's concert. I used to like the church services. There was a very nice padre there. But for me, being a Methodist, I got into the Methodist church there. And he was quite a nice man.
You remember his name?
No, he was a man who came from Preston, I think. And he had a church service every Sunday, and he was like me, absolutely hated this bingo. Even when he was having his church service in another part of the ship, you could still hear this monotonous call of bingo, you know. To me, like, I know. And I know some poor lads from in our division, the engineers, two lads from the Gateshead area, they ran a bingo. And in those days, on the ship, they made £120.
Between the pair of them?
Between them. So bingo.
They kept so much back.
Yeah, but it did them no good because it was stolen when we got to Durban.
Gambling, were there any forms of gambling on the ship?
No, gambling was strictly prohibited.
There was no cards going
on. Well, there was card schools, yes. But if the money was seen, you know, I mean, I can tell a tale of two brothers. This was in the Territorials. And they were playing for money. They were playing five card. What do they call it? Not brag. Anyway, they were playing this card game. And one of them said to his brother, who was the sergeant, "We're having an argument here on what is the highest call in this." Boy says, a mazare. I do remember that one. He says, "What for?" "Why," says, "you're not paying me." And he says, "I've just played a mazare." He says, "Have you?" He says, "Aye." "Why," says, "pay him up." So this lad paid his sixpence. And he put them both on a charge for gambling his own brother. The love of a stripe. And a true little story, huh?
Crown and Anchor with the naval people, did they try anything like that?
They tried that, but, that was taboo, though. Taboo. Never saw any gambler till I met Aussies.
We'll come to that probably later. Yeah. The boxing, did you have boxing
Yes, I had boxing tournaments. We had, you would fight, but in mine I never boxed. Oh, and it was in the ring once, I got hurt, and I didn't like that. you'd fight the 8th Battalion, or the 6th Battalion, or the Royal Engineers, or the Artillery, they were all at the teams. But army boxing was really tough. I've seen a padre stop the fight and say, "Sorry, if you don't make more blood, we'll have to cancel the contest." This was their idea of boxing, was blood. And we had a grand day, what they call crossing the line, which was crossing the equator, where you paid a certificate, you paid sixpence for this certificate signed by King Neptune, who was the ship's captain. To say you'd crossed the line from the north to the south. And these sixpences did go to the Merchant Navy's families. Rather a good scheme. And we had a good day there. You got doused in water and you had pillow fights over there. They used to put tarpaulins up on the deck and put seawater in so that you could get knocked off these poles and have a good day at that. As I say, one of the few times when the officers joined in, and everybody was supposed to go through this ritual. Rather good fun, because the officers were all dressed up with the captain was King Neptune and all his followers, and they kept the costumes for when they did it regular, I suppose. Was a rather a good day. And then
Did you have access to books at all? Was there a library on the...
No books, no. Very few, because people would never return them. I found that out.
Was there a canteen on the boat?
Not for long, it's all got sold out. It was that was one of the fiddles who were found out that they even... awful thing to say, but they used to keep food back off you at tea time and then sell it for supper. You know, the naval guys, they were in charge of the group, and then you got a cold tea, and you know, mine was good food on the ship.